Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today, I'll be taking time to speak with Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby, and economist Diane Lim for our next Economist Mom segment. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. The longest shutdown in American history finally ended after more than a month. A temporary budget deal was reached by elected leaders, reopening the government until February 15th. Over the next few weeks, the White House and Congress will try to come to an agreement on spending for border security and the final seven fiscal year 2019 appropriations bills before this short-term stopgap expires. The short-term bill also included provisions preventing spending cuts to mandatory programs, primarily Medicare, at the hands of sequester from taking effect. Under pay-as-you-go standards, the Office of Management and Budget is supposed to implement across-the-board cuts to any non-exempt program to eliminate deficits caused by enacted laws. But Congress has traditionally avoided the harsh cuts by suspending pay-go requirements, which it couldn't do during the shutdown. In fact, the OMB should have had to implement more than $800 million in cuts last week to this year's spending, about 90% of which would have hit Medicare reimbursements. The shutdown cost the nation $11 billion in inflation-adjusted economic output, according to a Congressional Budget Office analysis. A total of $3 billion was shaved from real gross domestic product in the fourth quarter of 2018, with the remaining $8 billion pulled from the first quarter of 2019. Although most of the real GDP lost will eventually be recovered, CBO estimates that about $3 billion will not be. The CBO also released its budget outlook this week, projecting that federal deficits and debt will rise rapidly despite healthy growth in the economy and an historically low unemployment rate. Over 10 years, the deficit is projected to increase by $11.6 trillion, with the debt projected to grow from 78% of GDP to 93%. At a time when we should be seeing annual federal deficits shrink, they are projected to average over $1 trillion annually for the next decade. CBO did say that the return of trillion-dollar deficits has been delayed until fiscal year 2022. It recently had projected we could see such high deficits as early as 2020. The CBO expects that lower disaster spending combined with other factors will help keep the difference between federal revenues and spending below the $1 trillion threshold for a few more years. Even still, deficits are projected to increase to an average 4.4% of economic output during that next decade, which is a jump from the 50-year average of 2.9% of GDP between 1969 and 2018. And in some ways, the numbers reflect an optimistic scenario because the CBO's projections are based on current law, and most legislators are discussing ways to increase spending and disregarding pay-go standards. Up next, economist Diane Lim will join me and Concord's Executive Director Bob Bixby for the next edition of our Economist Mom segment. We'll be taking time to talk about the end of the government shutdown and the Congressional Budget Office's latest 10-year budget outlook. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by economist Diane Lim and Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby. Diane is a principal at the District Economics Group. Both Diane and Bob are regular contributors on the show. Welcome back, Bob and Diane.
Thanks, Chase.
Thank you.
And we've got plenty to talk about. We had the end of the longest government shutdown in U.S. history. We had a big report come out from the Congressional Budget Office. Let's kick off with the big topic of the day, and that is the end of the government shutdown. My question to both of you is, what helped finally end that shutdown, and are we out of the woods yet?
Well, I think what helped end the shutdown was how unpopular the shutdown went over with the American public, and that was probably the number one action-forcing event that caused President Trump to basically act like it was they had reached a breakthrough and they're going to reopen the government and until mid-February, and they're going to continue negotiations about border security in the meantime. But I think that it was starting to look very worrisome, I have to say, as an economist, because it was unprecedented that the government would be shut down for so long and government workers that were involved would not get paid for so long. And so that got to be some serious amount of, I called it anti-stimulus going on. It's like, even if we were to consciously engage in contractionary economic policy, we would never do it that way. And we had never seen anything quite like that before, where you just take the opposite of what you would do in a recession in terms of injecting money into the economy from the government, withdrawing, holding back the money from the government. And we were getting to the point where my office has been tracking refunds this early in the year, because in a normal year, even in January, refunds go out. IRS processes tax refunds that are due to that are associated with prior tax years. So it would have been 2017 or earlier, because people file amended returns, and those amendments happen, or revisions or audited returns happen, many years, over the course of many years after a tax filing year. We were getting ready to see that if the shutdown had extended into February, we were talking about over $100 billion in tax refunds that wouldn't have gone out in time. And that is like a serious amount of money in terms of restricted cash flow. It is an anti-stimulus. You think about what was done during the Great Recession, and we were trying to inject that amount of money in every month. But, you know, it was exactly the opposite, and it was going to have a serious effect on the overall economy, a measurable, concerning effect on the overall economy. Even though the economy in general is in pretty good shape, it was not the time for an anti-stimulus.
Yeah, and I think the personal stories of federal workers and contractors, federal contractors, who, and contractors sounds like, you know, rich people or something, but I mean, you're talking about people that are cleaning buildings or providing food service or something like that. So the personal stories of what was happening to those people who were truly innocent victims of the shutdown was really beginning to weigh on the conscience of just about everybody. And so for this reason, government shutdowns have a shelf life, like a piece of fish. And after a while, they really do begin to smell bad. And that's what happened here. And to answer the second part of your question, which is, are we out of the woods? The answer is no. As Diane mentioned, the affected agencies are only funded through February 15th, so we'll soon be back at this again. I don't think there'll be another shutdown. I don't think there's any way that the Republicans on the Hill want to have anything more to do with a shutdown. But I do think that there won't be an agreement, because both sides aren't, I don't think, anywhere close to an agreement yet. So I do think that the president will probably attempt to evoke some sort of amorphous emergency power, which is not in the Constitution, by the way, and try to redirect some funds that have been appropriated for other purposes to the wall. And that'll be tested in the courts, and whether or not he has the statutory authority to do that is something that the courts are going to have to decide. But I should be clear, I'm very much opposed to that. I don't think he should go the emergency route, because I think it's a horrible precedent. But it seems to me a very tempting political option, like pressing the panic button.
But do you think, Bob, that that would go over well with the public?
I don't.
Yeah.
I don't, but it's contrary to Republican theory of limited government, because it would be the executive, you know, exercising extraordinary power, which is why he hasn't done it so far. But I'm guessing that the political emergency of not caving to the Democrats and not shutting down the government again, there's only one door open, and it may be that politically, that's the one the administration will take.
A desperate face-saving.
It has all of these. I don't like it. I'm just saying that, and it's a terrible thing, but it allows the president to say, I stood strong for the wall, you know, and if the Congress isn't going to protect the country, I'll do it myself. Sure, it's a grab of almost dictatorial authority, but it's, I think, politically would play better than, okay, Nancy didn't give me the money for the wall.
Before we dive much more into sort of the next steps over the next few weeks and maybe even how fiscal year 2020's budget cycle might be impacted, I did have a couple other questions. One had to do with the face of the shutdown, and that is the furloughed federal employees, about 800,000 of them. Are they getting paid now? Do they get back pay? How does that work coming out of that shutdown?
They are going to get paid. I don't think they've gotten paid yet, but soon, this week, I think they're supposed to get paid. And they will get paid for, they will get back pay, I assume, with the first, you know, the first chance that they have to get their regular pay started. You know, I think about the furloughed workers, the unpaid workers. I think that it really put a human face on government. So it might have been somewhat of a silver lining in that I feel like the rest of the American public, just hearing the stories and seeing the faces of the people who were adversely affected by the shutdown, it made people a little bit more aware of this is what government work is about. Because there were a lot of interviews with government workers talking about what they'd normally be doing and why they work for government. And it just made it, you know, painted a more vivid picture of what we get from what the role of government is in our, you know, more daily lives. And so I think that, I think it was ironically helpful for people to the broader general public to appreciate the role of government. Ironic, because the shutdown was sort of, I think it's part of this drain the swamp mentality, but I think that people came to have a bigger appreciation for the swamp. Like they came to see, hey, I like parts of that swamp, and it's, we shouldn't drain it. Like, you know, they saw the effect on the airports of the long lines to security. They heard the stories about how food safety inspections weren't being done. You know, they could see the effects on their friends and neighbors, you know, that they could see the effect on local businesses, certainly in the D.C. area. That was really apparent. And I just think that there was this kind of community kind of pitching in feel in the D.C. area. Certainly there was, you know, so many private businesses were pitching in and donating food and money to furloughed workers, you know, giving them free transportation and free food and free activities. And I think that there was this sense of community rallying around federal workers, even if you were not a federal worker affected by the shutdown. And that's the kind of thing that really is necessary throughout the country for people to appreciate the role of government and why it's important that we prioritize what the government does and we adequately fund the government. So I actually think it did the opposite of what maybe some intended for the shutdown to do, which is to, you know, to say government is too big anyway. We need to demonstrate that we don't really need it. Well, I think it demonstrated that we do really need government.
Let me make one other optimistic point. One good thing that may have come out of it is that it ended in such a debacle that for the White House, that I think it may put an end to shutdowns as a strategy for a while, maybe not forever, but this this is just such a clear loss politically that it may be a long time before anybody else decides that shutting down the government deliberately is a way to get what they want.
That's a really good point.
And piggybacking off of that point there, Bob, you mentioned you didn't think there'd be another shutdown. You referenced the political loss. Are you hearing any rumblings or seeing any proposals coming out of Congress right now that look beyond that February 15th deadline that have bipartisan support and, you know, should it come to that, have enough support to, say, override a veto?
No. I mean, I think what there may be some support for is a process reform that would eliminate the shutdowns by having an automatic, what's called a continuing resolution, which means if you don't pass an appropriation bill, it continues at the current level. So there's some talk about legislatively removing that possibility. I doubt that they'll pass that, but they might. There's a lot of talk about that. But in terms of coming together for over the border wall funding or something, I don't know. I mean, they obviously could. They had a deal in December. The president walked away from it. So I don't really see a lot of talk about some big deal right now.
I agree. It's just process stuff that they're talking about, but they're not really discussing substance and how to come together on substance.
So let's talk a little bit more about process. This is the fiscal year 2019 budget process we're still working on, even though we're in the middle of that particular fiscal year. How do you think this might bleed over into fiscal year 2020, which Congress should basically be already working on?
Well, I think that given that the House is now democratically controlled and there's a lot of talk about raising taxes, I expect that there will be some serious talk about raising more revenue and pressure to do so. And I don't see much happening on the entitlement spending side, but maybe I'm wrong there. I'm seeing a lot more possibility of revenue changes. You know, if you look at the CBO outlook, it's very clear that we're not on a good revenue path anymore in terms of it's just the gap is widening between spending and revenues. And we have, similar to back in with the Bush tax cuts, we have the situation that a fairly large chunk of the tax cuts are scheduled to expire within the 10-year budget window. And that's the only reason why the gap in the CBO outlook isn't as bad as it probably actually doesn't look as bad as it probably actually is in terms of policy, current policy. I am expecting and actually hopeful that there will be some action on the revenue side of the budget because the spending side is harder to do. The revenue side is fairly easy.
I think this year's shutdown debate, just to look at the appropriation bills again, is going to have a lasting negative effect. And if you liked this shutdown, wait till September, because I think that we're going to have another one.
That's bleak.
Yeah, the end of it, as Chase mentioned, this will be even bigger and better because it'll be the whole government. But look, I don't want to do gloom and doom, but the Congress had a good, they did have a good year on appropriation until you got to the end of the year, and the president insisted on the wall, and then we are where we are. So they should take up the 2020 bills, which are, will fund the government beyond September. And that's what they should be turning their attention to now. Here's the problem. If it's going to come up again, I mean, the president will propose money for the wall in his 2020 budget, and probably the Senate Republicans will put money in the in their budget for that, and the Democrats will not want it in there. But here's the thing where I think it could lead to a full government shutdown. It's all over this emergency thing that we talked about before. If the president goes the emergency route, the Democrats will put in every bill, every appropriation bill, a provision that no funds appropriated herein shall be used for the purposes of constructing a wall. That's their right. And the president has no right to spend money that isn't appropriated by Congress. So, and of course, he would veto such bills, and the Republicans in the Senate might not even go along with it or pass them. So you could, if the emergency track is passed, this is one reason I don't hope he doesn't go this route, is I think it will have the effect of shutting down the government in September because they won't be able to pass any appropriation bills for fiscal year 2020. Now, if he doesn't go the emergency route, maybe the fight will just be limited to the Department of Homeland Security and the rest of the government will be set free for 2020 and they'll get the bills passed on time.
This is Facing the Future, and I'm talking to Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby, and economist Diane Lim in our recurring segment, The Economist Mom. We've been discussing the end of the government shutdown and its potential impacts on the fiscal year 2020 budget process. And Diane, you mentioned a report from the Congressional Budget Office that I'd like to talk about now, and that was their 10-year budget outlook that was published just this week. And I think before I ask any specific questions about it, maybe both you and Bob could give a brief summary or synopsis of what that report even does and what it's supposed to be used for.
Okay, well, this is something the CBO produces every year, and often they have an update halfway through the year. But they project under current law what is the 10-year path, expected path of spending levels and revenue levels. And therefore, what is the difference between those levels, the deficit, and what is our current level of debt, the stock of the accumulated deficits relative to GDP, and what are the effects of specific policies, what is the contribution of specific policies to those numbers. So this is what's used by Congress to figure out what policies they want to change in terms of how it would affect the deficit outlook going forward. So it's something that certainly the committees in Congress, like the Ways and Means Committee and the Budget Committees, they pay a lot of attention to this document as they're kind of planning their proposal.
Yeah, and the outlook this year just confirms what we already knew, which is that the budget's on an unsustainable track, which is we've got a widening gap between revenues and spending. Both are projected to grow, but spending is projected to grow faster than revenues, and we're looking at trillion-dollar deficits reemerging in the next couple of years and getting bigger over time and, more importantly, growing as a share of the economy. There's nothing surprising in the sense that, you know, we knew this was the condition. What's important about this is just we get some, you know, an update on the numbers. But I think maybe the fundamental point to stress that the CBO seemed to put emphasis on this year is that it's highly unusual to be running large and growing deficits at a time of economic growth and low unemployment. And they went out of their way to note how unusual a budget deficit of this size is in those economic conditions. And that's certainly a subject for concern when you look forward.
Yeah, I think you could. There's a chart that kind of summarizes the CBO outlook. They actually did a really nice visual summary at the beginning of the report this year.
They did.
And, you know, full of pictures instead of a lot of words or tables even. And the chart that shows revenues as a share of GDP against outlays as a share of GDP is really good. I kind of wish there was recession shading in this diagram because it would illustrate that the weird situation we're in where deficits as a share of GDP have gotten bigger as the economy has gotten stronger. And, you know, if you go back and look at the chart for the Great Recession there, the jaws just opened up because of the Great Recession, because in a time of recession, you have this natural economic effect on spending and revenues that spending goes up because we have a lot of support, income support programs, and revenues go down because income goes down. So you get a natural increase in the deficit already, even if you don't change policy. Then on top of that, you usually are engaging in stimulus policy, which we did in boatloads during the Great Recession, which means you're cutting taxes and you're raising spending in order to stimulate demand. This is a time when we're not in a recessionary period. So normally we would be naturally running surpluses or, you know, we'd be reducing the deficit naturally. Like if we didn't mess around with policy and just let it go on autopilot, we'd be raising more revenue and we'd be cutting spending on safety net programs. Instead, we're seeing deficits go up instead of down, and they're going up to a level that means that the debt is growing faster than the economy is, and that is what defines an unsustainable fiscal outlook.
And Diane, before we jump into some of those numbers in that report, you mentioned something that sort of piqued my interest, and that is that the CBO's report or analysis is often used by Congress or committees of Congress. Is there any reason to doubt the numbers or projections by CBO? I mean, it has come under attack in recent years by both parties when either party didn't like a particular score on a piece of legislation. Is there any validity to that kind of criticism, or is it just a little bit of partisan politicking?
Well, economists aren't perfect.
It
is a difficult job to project what's going to happen in the economy, and when you're projecting what's going to happen in the federal budget, it starts from a projection of what's going to happen in the economy. You have to know what happens to the various pieces that define the tax base, right? So you need to know what income is going to be in order to figure out what income tax revenue is going to be. So it's a difficult task because CBO is not just forecasting the budget in this document. It's forecasting the economy and then layering the budgetary costs and revenues on top of that economic forecast. So it's tricky. The other part that's tricky, and the reason why CBO outlooks don't turn out to be true, is because they are required by law to only estimate the so-called baseline based on literally what's in current law. So, for example, they have to assume that things that are scheduled in current law to expire, because Congress wrote the law that way, that they actually expire. Well, things hardly ever expire, especially when they are called tax cuts. They hardly ever expire. They're routinely extended. But CBO's baseline is required. They're required to assume that they all go away as scheduled. So that's a reason why it's difficult to go back in time and talk about what went wrong with a CBO baseline. CBO themselves tries to do this. Every CBO outlook report says, what has changed since our last baseline? And so there's a little look back at how their projections have changed. And some of those projections change because legislation has changed or their economic forecast has changed, like the economy is not projected to maybe be as strong as they thought it was going to be last year. So there is some look back in terms of how it affects the 10 years ahead forecast. And there's an occasional look back as to how their forecasts have performed relative to what has actually been realized. But that realization, what actually happens to spending and revenue levels, is subject to legislative change, economics, and CBO's modeling of how the economy interacts with these budget spending and tax programs, which is a tricky thing to figure out. I'll just give you one example. And that is that the labor market has really been changing. The nature of work in America has changed a lot in that there are a lot of people who work so-called, sometimes they're called gig economy jobs, but they're, you know, independent contractor jobs. And these are jobs that are not traditional employer-employee jobs. And honestly, our income tax system was not built to handle the kind of non-traditional employment situation very well. So there's some worry, and that was voiced actually in the CBO Revenue Outlook chapter in this Outlook report, that we don't really understand. So there's not such a tight relationship anymore between the level of labor income in the economy and a forecast of income tax receipts, because the mix of income between, you know, regular employment income versus independent contractor income is changing, and the way our tax system requires people to file those taxes is different. There's a distinction. And we're an income-based system, tax system. We don't have a consumption tax like a lot of European countries do. So there's some worry out there that our tax system is increasingly unable to keep up with changes in how we earn income in our economy.
That sounds like a whole new program sometimes.
Yeah.
Chase, my only contribution on that would just be to say that there is no reason to doubt CBO's numbers from the political point of view. In other words, I agree with everything Diane said about the uncertainty of these projections. But nobody thinks that CBO has their finger on the scale one way or the other. They're absolutely rigorously nonpartisan and driven by academic analysis, and they frequently check their work with a range of economists coming from every perspective to update their models and get feedback. So all these things are uncertain, but no reason to think that CBO has some sort of agenda.
One question I did have, and I don't know that we've talked about it yet. Can the two of you give a quick rundown on some of the specifics, maybe how much debt is expected to be projected over the next 10 years, average deficits, what economic growth is supposed to look like based on current policy?
You know, what I can comment on, I think the CBO report says that deficits are projected to average 4.4% of GDP. Meanwhile, their economic growth projection is, the big number is 4.4% of GDP deficits, and average annual economic growth over the 10-year period of 1.7%. That doesn't fly. That's not going to work. So that's the big thing I would point to. Like I said, it's the definition of unsustainable, because that means the debt-to-GDP ratio is going to just keep on growing at a time when hopefully we could have stabilized it instead, or just slowed it down at least, right? And we're not doing that, unfortunately, while we're in economic circumstances where we could. It's just pointing a picture to the fact that revenues are not growing fast enough to keep up with spending levels, and that there's no reason for this to be happening in this strong of an economy. We should have been working to close the gap, not let the gap get bigger. But I'd like to put a pin on that for now. And because our colleague Phil Smith has just walked into the room, and I'm going to hand off to Phil now, and Phil and Bob will continue the discussion. Welcome, Phil.
Thank you so much, Diane. I appreciate that.
Well, Phil, we're glad to have you on the show. Diane, thanks so much for taking time again to do the Economist Mom segment with us. And Phil, I guess since we've got you on the mic, and for those who don't know, Phil is the Concord Coalition's national field director, so he's in charge of a lot of what we do at the grassroots level across the country. And that being the case, Phil, maybe you can give us a quick summary of what Concord is doing right now. We have all of these volunteers across the country. They're called fiscal lookouts. What are they doing at the moment in this very interesting fiscal climate?
Well, you said it perfectly. It is a very interesting fiscal climate, and people are coming out of the woodwork because of it. I think people are quite concerned about our long-term fiscal situation. They know that the national debt is really high, and they hear people like Diane and Bob by giving them warnings, and they're heeding those warnings by contacting Concord and wanting to know what to do to get involved. And so right now the Concord Coalition has some pretty serious activity in about 19 different states across the country. And it's just a really neat, broad selection of people. If you look at folks, we have a retired educator out in California who's volunteering for us, a young businessman out in Colorado and Wyoming who is working with a new member of Congress to try to set up town hall meetings. We have a financial planner down in Florida, a woman who has volunteered with us for years and years. She's near the state capitol down in Tallahassee, very, very active. Our volunteer of the year this year was Kevin Wiley in Indiana, and he just gave a big Rotary Club speech out in Indiana last week, and has been in contact with folks like Mitch Daniels, and is constantly looking for ways to keep fiscal issues on the front burner. Of course, Iowa and New Hampshire are always big places for us. New England has always been a natural, strong presence for the Concord Coalition because our original co-founders are from up there. And then in Maryland, we have a couple of volunteers that are just knocking it out of the ballpark, one of whom is a former congressional staffer, so she's a lot of help in dealing with members' offices and helping to educate them and their staff on these issues and what they can do to keep our issues front and center. And then also in Maryland, we have this young naval officer who, when he was in school, his instructor told him that, you know, the biggest, most important threat to the future of our country is not in Afghanistan or Iraq. It's actually our own fiscal policy. So he is helping out. And with them being so close to the nation's capital, we're able to engage them here out of our national office in the Washington, D.C. area. We've got a guy in Michigan that was very frustrated that his member of Congress wasn't doing any town hall meetings on these issues, so he took it upon himself to do his own town hall. So he had a constituent-led town hall meeting in Michigan to talk about fiscal issues and to run our federal budget exercise. In states like Minnesota and North Carolina, we don't just have one fiscal lookout. We have an entire committee of fiscal lookouts that are very, very active and doing all sorts of things. We have a businessman up in Fargo, North Dakota, that's setting up things with the local chamber and has put us in touch with his company for us to give a big speech to the annual meeting of his company. So if you look at the list, and we've got a couple great fiscal lookouts down in Texas that have all kinds of things going on. So it really is just a broad geographic selection and people from across ideologies, too, because they know that this really isn't an ideological problem as much as it's a math problem. And so I'm happy to report that the Concord field operation may be more active than it's been in years right now because of our situation, Chase.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And I probably should clarify, a lot of those fiscal lookouts have been deemed sort of the state volunteer coordinator for a lot of the grassroots activities. And they also recruit additional volunteers to get involved with activities that Concord is doing in those particular states or regions of the country. If one of our listeners, Phil, had interest in getting involved, how would they get in touch with you?
Absolutely. Send me an email at psmith@concordcoalition.org. That's psmith@concordcoalition.org. Or feel free just to pick up the phone and give me a call at 404-354-7445. And we have all sorts of ways to get involved. We train people to give our chart talk presentation. We have our federal budget exercise that we run on college campuses around the country. And basically we try to figure it out, you know, what the volunteer, what their strengths are and what they want to do, and then walk them through a variety of ways that they can help educate their fellow citizens about these fiscal issues. If you know, look back at the formation of our country, it's so important to have an educated electorate. And I think it's so much the case with federal budget policy. There's so many myths that we have to debunk and so many facts and figures that we've got to get out there. We've got to get beyond the bumper sticker talk. And this is how we do it. It's an army of people across the country. And that's how you really affect change, I think, in the long run. Is these volunteers are real people with real concerns. They're business people, they're family people. They're in it for the long haul. They're not just short-term thinkers. They're long-term thinkers. And we need more in our ranks. We can't do this by ourselves, obviously.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time to give us a quick little update on what Concord's doing across the country, and I would encourage any of our listeners, definitely reach out to Phil. He's also happy to talk to you more about the issues and how you can get more involved. And, Bob, I wanted to bring you back in before we end this segment. I had one last question for you, and it's going back to the Congressional Budget Office's report, their 10-year outlook. What are you hoping this document communicates to policymakers, maybe even those that are running for president? What is the action step you hope comes from a document like this?
Basically, it's education, Chase. I mean, it'd be easy to say, gee, I hope this shocks them into some sort of big budget deal that changes all these numbers and makes them look better. That isn't going to happen. So I think the important, what I would take away and what I would urge candidates to take away from this and the folks in Washington is just have an appreciation for where we are. This is a problem that we need to deal with. It's not going to go away. So stop ignoring it, I think, is the message here. We've described it, and Diane has talked about the gap between revenue and spending. It's not complicated. The spending is rising because very good and popular programs like Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid, things having to do with retirement and health care, are growing faster than the economy, because they grow on autopilot and there are a lot of people retiring as the baby boom generation ages. And as healthcare costs continue to outpace the economy, so, and the economy itself is not performing as well as it used to, partially for that same reason, because the workforce growth is slowing. So how do you deal with that? How do you confront that situation? I wish it was just a case of fighting waste, fraud, and abuse. It's not. There's a basic structural problem both with the federal budget and with the economy. And I would hope that candidates and members of Congress begin to come forward with proposals that will deal with that. There really aren't any on the table right now. People have all sorts of ideas for what they would like to do. And some of them might be good ideas, but they only would address one part of this. And, either by cutting spending in some cases, or some people want to raise taxes. And, we do need to get together on some sort of a mix of policies that will make us sustainably solvent as a nation over the years.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me, Bob Bixby, Diane Lim, and even Phil Smith chimed in to give a quick update on Concord grassroots efforts. We touched on CBO projections as well as the end of the government shutdown and how it might impact upcoming fiscal years and the budget process there. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back after these short messages for our final segment, Facing the Facts. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and this is our final segment, Facing the Facts, where I share with you a fact or a piece of information that I think is worth you pondering until next week's show. So, it's time to face this fact. The independence and credibility of the Congressional Budget Office are essential. With unprecedented fiscal trends like increasing deficits at a time of economic growth, debt service costs expected to eclipse defense spending, mandatory spending programs consuming well over half of the budget, and more, reports like the one discussed on the show today are critical in the fiscal policy discussion, bipartisan solutions, and long-term sustainable reform. The Congressional Budget Office, or CBO, provides a critical service for policymakers and the public, projecting the budgetary and economic impacts of proposed legislation. Since its inception in 1974, CBO has established an unparalleled track record for objectivity and analytical rigor. It is the referee, often criticized, but usually the most reliable source of such analysis. CBO's reputation was not established overnight. It is the result of more than four decades of consistently impartial analysis, facilitated by directors who worked tirelessly to maintain the organization's credibility and objectivity. CBO's methodologies and assumptions are fully transparent and are as analytically rigorous as any in Washington and the private sector. Policymakers have at times denigrated CBO, primarily when it provides unfavorable scores of policies that they support or favorable scores of policies they oppose. Democrats criticized it during the original debate over the Affordable Care Act for underestimating the degree to which their proposals could control health care costs. Republicans have worked to undermine CBO's credibility over its politically problematic estimates of House GOP proposals for replacing the ACA. But CBO's projections have nonetheless served as the closest thing to a common set of facts for policy debates in Congress and among the American public. Without CBO's work as the agreed-upon nonpartisan source of budgetary projections, policymakers would be flying blind, or worse, encouraged to shop around for the most favorable score. That would only serve to increase the highly partisan atmosphere on Capitol Hill. There should only be one official scorekeeper, and CBO is it. A universally accepted baseline off of which to work is critical not only for policymakers, but for the Concord Coalition's efforts to engage Americans on a grassroots level about the federal budget. The broad acceptance of CBO projections enables participants in budget exercises and policy forums to discuss and consider trade-offs based on commonly recognized facts. And in the era of partisan sources of information, reinforced echo chambers, allegations of fake news, and the intrusion of outside influences on what's trending or what's considered fact, having a commonly recognized set of facts is unbelievably important. The independence and credibility of CBO should be considered beyond reproach, so it can continue to serve its vital role as the impartial arbiter of public policy debates, both inside and outside of Washington. You have been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.